Chapter 7, Continued.
2 years before the NKVD arrested Solzhenitsyn, somewhere in eastern Prussia, William C. Bullitt, the former and first U.S. ambassador to the USSR, laid before his good friend Franklin Roosevelt a detailed prophecy contained in a letter of all that was about to happen to the world, given the USA's current course of action, and that did happen. This letter, dated January 29, 1943, is surely one of the most remarkable documents to come out of World War II. Not too many years earlier, Bullitt had been a famed, really notorious, Sovietophile who, as a 42-year-old assistant to the Secretary of State, enthusiastically shepherded the 1933 negotiations leading to U.S. recognition of the USSR. His role was key. Soviet pact held Bullitt triumph, as one newspaper headlined it. His uncle Archdeacon James F. Bullitt's reaction to the pact was also front-page news. Bullitt's uncle says Soviet deal disgraces United States. Uncle Bullitt turns out to have been savvier than his nephew. Russia will keep no promises with us, he correctly predicted. But William Bullitt's disillusionment was not long in coming. As ambassador on post, Bullitt soon realized that every pledge, promise, and assurance that the United States had extracted from the Soviets on war debt, on the treatment of American nationals and property in the USSR, on religious freedom, on subversion of the United States, and of course on revolution in the United States, in exchange for recognition, wasn't worth the rags the paper was printed on. This was becoming patently clear to him by 1935, after Stalin convened the world's communist parties, including the American Communist Party, in the 7th World Congress of the Communist International. CPUSA leaders, Earl Browder and William Foster, took leading roles in the Congress. This display directly violated Soviet pledges to refrain from directing subversive activities in the United States. It turns out that Bullitt, despite his subsiding Sovietophilia, was a fact-based, enlightenment kind of guy after all. It seems he couldn't help himself, not while watching his pet theories about workers' paradise crack up against the facts. His cable to FDR on July 15, 1935, captures a mind in flux, no longer weighted down by delusion and wishful thinking. He has grasped the communist mind. He doesn't advise Roosevelt to break relations, although he discusses it as a possible American response in the event that violations of the recognition agreement at the Comintern Congress, still unfolding, turned out to be not technical but gross and insulting. In that event, he wrote, he suspected FDR will feel obliged to break relations. Bullitt suspected wrong. He continued, if we should not break relations, the Soviet government would be convinced that it could break its pledges with impunity and would feel free to direct actively the American communist movement. Would feel free? The Soviet government was already doing precisely that, and more inside the United States, as Bullitt would later learn. This would have been a perfect moment to cast out the snake. Simply to treat Stalin like an adult, as a future ambassador, William H. Standley, would similarly advise the president in late 1942. Keep any promises we make to him, but insist that he keep his promises too. It sounds so simple. It was so simple. However, it was rational, too, and reason had no place in this sick relationship. For those who tried to inject it, there was only frustration. Most people didn't. So it would be that in 1982, when Ronald Reagan asked his Arms Control Advisory Committee to conduct a review of Soviet compliance in 25 years of arms control treaties, there had not been such a review for years. The answer to Reagan's question on Soviet compliance was that there was none. In his excellent 1988 study of the West's resolve to ignore the implications of communist ideology in its relations with the USSR, Why the Soviets Violate Arms Control Treaties, Joseph D. Douglas, Jr. takes note of this pattern of behavior adopted by the Western world. The Soviet Union repeatedly violates treaties, and the rest of the world turns their heads and proceeds to enter into still more treaties, which the Soviets violate with impunity. Back at the beginning, back at the source, not even the accomplished bullet could stop it, although he did try. Days after his July 1935 letter to FDR about the Comintern Congress, he wrote a startlingly prophetic cable to Secretary of State Hull, emphasizing the point that contrary to reports, beliefs, and desires, and of course disinformation, but he didn't mention that, there had been no decrease in the determination of the Soviet government to produce world revolution. If this basic postulate of the Soviet government is understood, there is little or nothing in Soviet domestic or foreign policy that is not clear. As if to prove his own point, Bullitt proceeded to explain the Soviets' hardiest hope for war between Japan and the United States, which they would enter after Japan had been thoroughly defeated, to acquire Manchuria and Sovietize China, and for war in Europe between Germany and France, which they would similarly exploit to protect and consolidate any communist governments which may be set up as a result. That was written in July 1935. There was little or nothing in Soviet domestic or foreign policy that wasn't clear to Bullitt. But such clarity impinged on his relationship with Roosevelt, who preferred the view through rose-red colored glasses. While their friendship became strained, Bullitt would continue to press his case. In the extraordinary letter to FDR dated January 29, 1943, noted above, Bullitt warned Roosevelt what would happen if the president continued pursuing the policies of appeasement towards Stalin that formed the foundation of the American war strategy. Specifically, Bullitt pleaded with the president not to permit our war to prevent Nazi domination of Europe to be turned into a war to establish Soviet domination of Europe. 15 thoughtful pages later, Bullitt had accurately foretold that the Soviet Union would annex half of post-Hitler Europe, with the grotesque effect being that the United States had gone to war to replace one tyrant with an even bigger tyrant. George F. Kennan later tagged this letter as the earliest warning of the effective division of Europe that would ensue if the war continued under prevailing policy. It was a policy based on what Bullitt called the vice of wishful thinking, unsupported by any evidence. Wishful thinking in the 1940s was no different from wishful thinking in the 1930s. It had become, however, the basis of an incessant propaganda campaign controlled through the absolute powers of the federal government in wartime. It was also promulgated and promoted by communist-penetrated government agencies such as the OWI. The basic story, repeated over and over again, was that Stalin had changed. Stalin had no interest in territorial gains or world revolution, and Stalin was taking the Soviet Union in the direction of democracy and liberty. This was exactly the set of lies that military analyst Hanson Baldwin identified as great mistakes of the war in his 1949 book of the same name. What Bullitt understood early on, however, was that these lies were no mistake. Instead, and this is crucial, they were exactly the view being propagated by the Comintern, he elaborated. It is the Communist Party line in Great Britain, the United States, and all other countries where there are communist parties. It is the line of fellow travelers and many liberals. Since Stalin personally sets the party line, it is what Stalin wants us to believe about him. the most careful search for factual evidence to support the thesis that Stalin is a changed man reveals none. The most careful search for evidence reveals none, but reveals Bullitt to have inhabited the universe of reason. Without supporting facts, there could be no conclusion to the contrary, and wishful thinking wasn't enough to base battle plans on, a lesson our leadership still hasn't learned, as we see in Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere. Ideology was and is no substitute for reality. What despair, what frustration, must have descended on Bullitt when he realized, in the course of a 3-hour discussion with FDR about this January 29, 1943 letter, that the president, in response to his reasoned arguments, was regurgitating exactly the same Communist Party line.
"Bill, I don't dispute your facts. They are accurate," Bullitt quoted FDR as saying. "I don't dispute the logic of your reasoning. I just have a hunch that Stalin is not that kind of a man. Harry says he's not, and that he doesn't want anything in the world but security for his country, and I think that if I give him everything I possibly can and ask nothing from him in return, noblesse oblige, he won't try to annex anything and will work with me for a world of democracy and peace."
Translation: Bullitt's facts are accurate, just as Robert Conquest's facts would be 30, 40 years later. Bullitt's logic, too, is undisputable. It's just the implications of those facts and logic that FDR could not, would not, accept. Yes, we're back to that. The same sundering of fact from implication that has plagued us since Soviet recognition. The same quarantine around knowledge, preventing contamination by conclusion. Instead, we see the insidious infiltration of emotion and ideology, action based on theory, and theory based on propaganda. Then there's the say-so of our old friend Harry Hopkins, a point most historians, Paul Kengor has noted, snip from the Bullitt quotation, the better to fit their existing view of the world. As a result of this juggernaut, Bullitt and other students of traditional reason became caught up in a new force field, a reverse Big Bang that froze rather than enlivened the building blocks of reason at the core of Western society. Black became white. Defeat became victory. Stalin worked for world peace. Elizabeth Bentley was a liar. By the time Orwell sat down in a lonely farmhouse in the Scottish Hebrides to write about far-off 1984, he was no longer operating in the realm of science fiction. Western society was already a theater of lies and paradox, driven by the vice of wishful thinking, as Bullitt put it, conditioned and regulated according to an unprecedented Soviet-directed, American-executed, worldwide propaganda campaign. Bullitt revealed this conversation with FDR in an article he wrote for Life magazine called How We Won the War and Lost the Peace. It was August 1948. The following year, Orwell's instantly timeless vision of a world upside down came out, received as fantasy about mind control and ideological domination. Bullitt's article reveals it all in momentous action, with Harry, not incidentally, manning an important control lever. In his letter to Roosevelt, Bullitt elaborated on the dangers of self-deception. Wishful thinking has produced the following logic. Because the Red Army has fought magnificently, the Soviet Union is a democratic state, which desires no annexation and is devoted to the four freedoms. Because Stalingrad has been defended with superb heroism, there is no OGPU, or secret police. This rang a bell. In his 1973 memoir, Witness to History, veteran diplomat Charles E. Chip Bolin, a protege of Harry Hopkins, by the way, whose 1953 appointment by Eisenhower to become U.S. ambassador to Moscow was unsuccessfully contested by Senate anti-communists as a continuation of Rooseveltian appeasement policies, noted the impact of Soviet propaganda in America. Bolin was specifically referring to the efforts of party line boys to promote the Soviet Union in the heat of the war effort. With some people, he wrote, these feelings were so strong, you could hardly say it was cold in Russia without being accused of being anti-Soviet. Shortly after the Soviet victory at the Battle of Stalingrad, which was right about the time Bullitt wrote to FDR in January 1943, Bolin recalled, one night, at a party where the Russians were being lionized, John Russell, a young officer in the British Embassy, whom I had known in Moscow, observed, there are people in town who think the defense of Stalingrad proves there is no GPU. This is Bullitt's anecdote exactly. Now, it's quite possible that Bullitt and Bolin, colleagues from the U.S. Embassy in Moscow, back when Bullitt was ambassador, were standing, cocktail to cocktail, hearing the same story at the same party. However, Viktor Kravchenko reports encountering much the same argument in his American travels, and repetitiously so. The non-logical progression that linked Russia's tragically costly victories with the genius of Bolshevism, or even the rightness of the regime. To Americans, Kravchenko wrote, Hitler's offensive proved only that the beast was mighty, but Stalin's counteroffensive somehow confirmed the validity of Bolshevism. As a Soviet official under near constant supervision, Kravchenko said, I could not speak up, could not defend my countrymen against the monstrous perversion of the facts. 1,000 times I had to listen in frustrated silence while the Soviet dictatorship was being given full credit for the achievements of the Russian people. He continued, someone, somewhere, had manipulated the surge of fellow feeling for Russians for Stalin's benefit, and not, as Kravchenko fervently wished, for the democratic aspirations of the Russian people. Americans seemed intent on explaining everything in Stalin's favor to the discredit of the democracies, he observed. He added, an incredible thing seemed to have happened in the American mind. The Soviet dictatorship was fully identified with the Russian people. What the communists had not yet succeeded in doing in their own country, as the purges and the millions of political prisoners indicate, they had succeeded in doing in America. This is a stunning assessment, testament to the successful penetration, infiltration, and subversion of key strategic territory, the American mind. As Kravchenko further ventured into discussions with Americans, he also came to believe that Russians, trained over the years to discount propaganda and read between the lines of the Soviet state-run press, had an advantage over Americans who, confident of the freedoms protected by the First Amendment, accepted propaganda transmitted by correspondents, uncritical or censored, from Moscow. They also accepted the news as produced by communist-penetrated U.S. government organs, such as Voice of America or the Office of War Information, state-run media, U.S. style. Every Kremlin lie or diplomatic twist found readier credence here than at home, he observed. It was a remarkable flip that he described. Slave labor, famine, police dictatorship, these were things of which everyone inside Russia was deeply conscious, he wrote. There might be apologists or fatalists who shrugged them off, he continued, but it would not occur to us to deny them. Americans, however, did both. Then for Kravchenko, the light dawned. The greatest Soviet triumph, it was borne in upon me, was in the domain of foreign propaganda. The reaction to Kravchenko's defection provides a case in point. The logic behind Kravchenko's clean break from his past life was that Soviet Russia was a totalitarian monstrosity akin to Nazi Germany. Once FDR believed that, or rather delivered a speech saying so.
The Soviet Union is run by a dictatorship as absolute as any other dictatorship in the world,
he said on February 10th, 1940, 3 months before H.H. moved in to stay. Of course, to anyone with a stake, ideological, careerist, or misguided, in preserving the pro-Soviet status quo, this was unthinkable, unspeakable, and literally so. By this point, readers may not be shocked to learn that it was silence that largely greeted Kravchenko's sensational defection in March 1944, as noted by Time magazine. Editorial comment was minimum and cautious. Most U.S. editors, mindful of the delicacy of U.S.-Soviet relations, of the gravity of the war, and of the 26-year-old difficulty in getting at the truth in any item dealing with Russia, did not want to stick out their necks. A neat rationale, euphemistically packaged. Still, it is hard not to be grateful for the confessional note about necks. As seen in the spotty coverage of the 1932-1933 terror famine a decade earlier, factors having zero to do with delicate U.S.-Soviet relations, war, or any supposed difficulty in getting at the truth about Russia, had already turned an ostensibly free press into a school of turtles in the recoiled position. A deaf and dumb reporter, hermetically sealed in a hotel room, could not have escaped knowledge of the essential facts Eugene Lyons had written of his own and his colleagues' shameful terror-famine whitewash. This, the first big lie, as Conquest noted, was the original sin committed by a smallish fraternity. It was a precursor to the institutional fall, as marked by U.S. recognition of the USSR. We had lower depths to plumb, our own active collaboration in big lies, which wasn't evident until what is known as the Katyn Forest Massacre. When, in early April of 1943, 1 year before Kravchenko's defection, the mass graves of thousands of shot, bayoneted, and asphyxiated Polish officers began to be uncovered beneath the pines in the forest of Katyn near Smolensk, Russia, by invading Nazi troops, all of the ghoulish evidence, the Nazis said, and triumphantly so, pointed to Soviet guilt. Nazi propaganda, thundered Stalin. German fascists had executed the Polish officers, he told FDR in an aggressive rant on April 21, 1943, that excoriated their mutual ally, the Polish government in exile, for daring to call in the nonpartisan International Red Cross to investigate this crime against Polish humanity. Then what happened? Before I write the answer, I would like to introduce a hypothetical case for a moment. Imagine the plight of a people forced to repeat and live by a conqueror's lies. A familiar enough tableau from the past century. We shake our heads sadly, if also a little smugly, and shrug in empathetic embarrassment that any nation should be reduced to such servility. But as the story of Katyn Forest Massacre tells us, or rather the story of the story of the Katyn Forest Massacre tells us, we must ask ourselves what difference there is between that hypothetical subject nation and our own. The Allied reaction to the Soviet massacre of 22,000 Polish officers is what some would, did, and do call denial for the greater good. I have concluded it was our moral unraveling. The simplest chronology follows. On April 13, 1943, Radio Berlin broadcast news of the German discovery of thousands of corpses of Polish officers who, the report said, had been executed by the NKVD when the Soviets held the territory in the spring of 1940. Was this unscrupulous Nazi propaganda designed to hide yet another Nazi atrocity? Or did this appalling discovery explain why it was that Stalin told the Allies he was unable to locate thousands of Polish officers missing in Soviet-controlled territory for almost 2 years? On April 15, 1943, Radio Moscow countered that the Poles had died at the hands of the German fascist hangmen in the summer of 1941. Not until 1990, 47 years later, would the Soviet regime finally admit the truth. The Katyn massacre was a Soviet crime. Also, on April 15, 1943, the Polish government in exile in London asked the Independent International Red Cross in Geneva to investigate the scene of this massive crime. It simultaneously underscored its unaltered antipathy for the Nazi regime. Poland, after all, had been invaded by Soviets and Nazis both in September 1939, another historical fact we forget. The Nazis also called in the Red Cross, desperately hoping to capitalize, kettle calling pot black style, on the evident butchery of the Soviets. The Swiss aid organization agreed to investigate, but only on the condition that all three interested parties, Germany, Poland, and the USSR, agreed. The USSR did no such thing, instead throwing fits that, like a crazy girlfriend, would turn its junior partners into desperate, placating suitors. On April 19th, the Soviet organ Pravda smeared the Poles as Hitlerite lackeys, who would go down in history as the helpmates of cannibal Hitler. On April 23rd, Elmer Davis, famed journalist, radio personality, and chief of the Office of War Information, broadcast a report on Katyn parroting Soviet lies that Katyn was a Nazi crime, setting the line for U.S. government information agencies that wouldn't be broken until 1951. On April 24th, Churchill cabled Stalin that he was thinking about silencing those Polish papers in this country which attack the Soviet government. On April 25th, Stalin thanked Churchill for his interest in the matter and announced he would be breaking relations with the Poles due to public opinion in the Soviet Union. Ha! Which is extremely indignant at the ingratitude and treachery of the Polish government. Historian Lawrence Rees comments, "It is worth noting the lengths to which Stalin now felt confident to take this device of protesting at being accused of a crime that he knew he had committed." On April 26th, the USSR broke relations with the Polish government for its completely natural, understandable response to evidence indicating that the Soviets had decimated the Polish elite in cold blood. On April 28th, Winston Churchill cabled Stalin that he had told the Poles that there could be no fruitful relationship with the USSR while they make charges of an insulting character against the Soviet government and thus seem to countenance atrocious Nazi propaganda. On April 30th, an ad hoc committee of experts invited by the Nazis from 12 European universities and neutral countries unanimously dated the time of the massacre to the spring of 1940, when the area was under Soviet control. Back in the States, Harry Hopkins privately beat back suspicion of the Soviets by accusing the Poles, who at the time had some 80,000 troops fighting against the Axis powers, of falling under the influence of large Polish landlords who simply wanted to keep their estates out of Russian hands. As for FDR, after receiving a toxic blast of propaganda from Stalin about the Poles' absolutely abnormal and vile slander, dated April 21, 1943, Roosevelt soothingly replied on April 26th, "I can well understand your problem. The Poles made a stupid mistake in asking the International Red Cross to investigate. Thankfully, somebody, I think it was supposed to have been Secretary of State Cordell Hull, got FDR to cross out the word stupid before the cable went out. On May 1st, the Polish government in exile withdrew its request for the Red Cross investigation. On May 5th, FDR, apparently impressed for all the wrong reasons, effectively pledged fealty to the brute. He wrote a personal letter to Stalin to be hand-delivered by professional sycophant and all-around boob Joseph Davies, proposing a tete-a-tete between you and me. No staff, other than Harry Hopkins Natch, would be invited, plus an interpreter and a stenographer. Definitely no Winnie. It wasn't only that all was forgiven by FDR, all was ignored. Not by everyone, though. By the third week of May, an Anglo-Irish diplomat named Owen O'Malley had completed a lengthy, careful, and logical analysis of the Katyn case that began to circulate within the British government. It left little doubt that Katyn was a Soviet atrocity. More than that, this document attests to the existential damage underlying the British and, by extension, American cover-up of the atrocity. Historian Lauren Rees calls O'Malley's cri de coeur one of the most remarkable documents in the history of Anglo-Soviet relations. I would go further still and call it one of the most remarkable documents of the century, evoking Shakespeare and Plutarch in its narrative of quandary foreshadowing tragedy. It is an expression and elucidation of the very mindset I have been writing this book to try to understand. O'Malley enters this roiling philosophical deep by acknowledging as a given the constraints imposed by our urgent need for cordial relations with the Soviet government. This, he continues in his report's concluding section, makes us appear to appraise the evidence with more hesitation and lenience than we should do in forming a common-sense judgment on events occurring in normal times or in the ordinary course of our private lives. This tells us that O'Malley's meticulous analysis of events which precedes this statement is in fact restrained, and that in holding back common sense, he is also withholding normal judgment. This emphasis on the purposeful suppression of normal reactions is key. It characterizes the basis of the West's abnormal relationship to communism. O'Malley continues, "We have been obliged to appear to distort the normal and healthy operation of our intellectual and moral judgments. If I were writing an English paper on the O'Malley report, I would jump all over the use of the passive voice, 'We have been obliged,' as a means of denying volition, avoiding responsibility. I understand O'Malley is referring to the policy of desperation set by British and American leaders to retain Soviet Russia as an ally against Nazi Germany at all costs. A policy that was, in all probability, the result of a brilliant Soviet influence operation. It had become unthinkable that there was any way to victory that did not defer to Soviet whim, feelings, and strategic advantage. But there was a shorter life and treasure-saving route. As Solzhenitsyn would later tell us, world democracy could have defeated one totalitarian regime after another, the German and then the Soviet. Instead, it strengthened Soviet totalitarianism and helped bring into existence a third totalitarianism, that of China. So tell me again, who won World War II? In flagging the repression of common sense and judgment, he observed the British and Americans engaged in to conform to the Soviet version of Katyn. O'Malley also offers a glimpse into our new role as official promulgators of a big lie. This is nothing less than the act of the moral vassal who, having bent to the Soviet standard, has accepted and legitimized it. Morals and ethics do not exist here as we understand them. U.S. Ambassador to Moscow, Lawrence Steinhardt, wrote from Moscow in 1940. This meant that Westerners raised on Judeo-Christian morals and ethics either had to reject communism's nullification of them or embrace communism's nullification of them. O'Malley's report demonstrates the extent to which the communist interpretation had been embraced, internalized even. He continues, ticking off some of the unnatural acts that followed from such acquiescence. We have been obliged to give undue prominence to the tactlessness or impulsiveness of Poles, to restrain the Poles from putting their case clearly before the public, to discourage an attempt by the public and the press to probe an ugly story to the bottom. I am suddenly put in mind of more contemporary Western constraints imposed on a kind of latter-day Poland, Israel, in the face of our capitulations to Islam. O'Malley goes on. In general, we have been obliged to deflect attention from possibilities which in the ordinary affairs of life would cry to high heaven for elucidation, and to withhold the full measure of solicitude which, in other circumstances, would be shown to acquaintances situated as the Poles now are. Here we plainly see expressed a double moral standard, the Poles, meanwhile, at that moment, fighting and dying in the North Africa campaign, were much more than acquaintances and deserved far better than the callous cover-up O'Malley describes. What we see in Allied behavior, as described by the 57-year-old courier diplomat, is nothing less than a Frankensteinian transformation of human nature as observed, not just by a sharp eyewitness, but also by a participating and aghast guinea pig. Normal, healthy common sense and judgment have been proscribed. O'Malley understands that what has supplanted them is a reflex mendacity shaped by unnatural and nerve-wracking constrictions of morality and logic. Echoes of Macbeth follow. We have, in fact, perforce, used the good name of England like the murderers used the little conifers to cover up a massacre. Then the pivot. And in view of the immense importance of an appearance and of the heroic resistance of Russia to Germany, few will think that any other course would have been wise or right. As abnormal, unhealthy, unordinary as this course was, no other course could possibly have been wise or right. Really? O'Malley himself doesn't seem entirely convinced. He goes back to contemplating those little conifers, the trees the Soviets planted over the mass graves in the forest, and how they might grow. This dislocation between our public attitude and our private feelings we may know to be deliberate and inevitable, but at the same time we may perhaps wonder whether, by representing to others something less than the whole truth, as far as we know it, and something less than the probabilities, so far as they seem to us probable, we are not incurring a risk of what, not to put a fine point on it, might darken our vision and take the edge off our moral sensibility. Exquisite excruciations aside, the big lie about Katyn, born in Moscow, would grow in London and Washington. That vision O'Malley references was shot, that moral edge gone. Otherwise we, would not have even considered incurring more of what O'Malley calls risk. The Katyn cover-up, then, was a grisly manifestation of our fallen state of mind. What O'Malley depicts is a Dorian Gray-style portrait of moral decrepitude on the one hand and communist power and influence on the other. We were on their string. The cold logic behind the Realpolitik response to the O'Malley report by British Foreign Secretary Sir Alexander Cadogan is more confirmation of this subject's status. Cadogan himself wanted to suppress the O'Malley report, stopping it from circulating further even within the British government. He writes, "I confess that, in cowardly fashion, I had rather turned my head away from the scene at Katyn, for fear of what I should find there. I think no one has pointed out that, on a purely moral plane, these are not news. How many thousands of its citizens has the Soviet Union butchered? These thousands killed are not news any more than those other thousands, millions actually, killed were news. They died on the very edge of Europe, and Europe didn't even notice it. The world didn't even notice it. 6 million persons." So Solzhenitsyn exclaimed about the terror famine in 1975, and millions more had perished since, even before Hitler had liquidated his first million. What horrors these two monsters both were! Why was it wrong to think that? Cadogan's answer, the crime family logic of the capo coming through in Oxbridge overtones, was that the deal with the Soviet devil had been struck long ago. Stick to it. He continued, falling back on the crutch of inevitability O'Malley had leaned on. "Quite clearly, for the moment, there is nothing to be done. Of course, it would be only honest to circulate the O'Malley report. But as we all know, that the knowledge of this evidence cannot affect our course of action or policy, is there any advantage in exposing more individuals than necessary to the spiritual conflict that a reading of the document excites?" Here is the template of moral abdication of the Western world. When knowledge and evidence cannot affect our course of action, knowledge and evidence become an unnecessary source of spiritual conflict, not a guide, not an inspiration for moral behavior, for logical action. From the same fount of expediency flows the fractured reaction to conquest. "We accept your facts, old boy, just not your implications. Certainly not in such a way as to affect our course of action. After all, old bean, we are morally dead, captives of communist ideology, or communist blackmail at any rate, which means much the same thing in the end, what? Why expose others to the spiritual conflict this dashed old massacre might arouse, when our collusion in silence is assured anyway? Now we are all complicit." From such chilling candor, from such civilized quarters, we get a glimpse into exactly how great terrors and blood purges are rationalized and thus enabled. Don't look, don't think, don't feel. No need to get excited. There's nothing to do about it anyway. Unsatisfied, perhaps, Cadogan would carry this debate into the pages of his diary. On June 18, 1943, the decision to go ahead in 1944 with the Normandy invasion, Stalin's Second Front, having been recently made. He notes, "I pointed out that years before Katyn, the Soviet government had made a habit of butchering their own citizens by the 10,000s, and if we could fling ourselves into their arms in 1941, I don't know that Katyn makes our position more delicate." He was right. It didn't. So long as there was no reckoning, no return to standards that not so long ago made normal relations with the Soviet Union impossible, Katyn did not make the Allied position more delicate. It did, however, make it more intensively redolent of spoiled fish, and, worse, made the Allies complicit, for the first time, in doing our concerted part to preserve and elaborate on a new big lie. This one, to some transformational extent, of our own official making. Katyn couldn't have lived on without Churchill and Roosevelt. It couldn't have breathed, couldn't have sustained itself. When people renounce lies, they simply cease to exist. Like parasites, they can only survive when attached to a person, wrote Solzhenitsyn. The problem always is, one lie begets another. 3 decades later, Alexander Solzhenitsyn would express his puzzlement over how this predicament had come about. Remember his figures. 17 a year. 10 a month. More than 1,000 a month. More than 40,000 a month. Thus, he said, that which had made it difficult for the democratic West to form an alliance with pre-revolutionary Russia had, by 1941, grown to such an extent and still did not prevent the entire united democracies of the world from entering into a military alliance with the Soviet Union. At Katyn, it still did not prevent those same united democracies from themselves entering into criminal conspiracy with the Soviet Union. Here is where we see the communist triumph in the inversion of Western morality and logic to serve communist ends, and not just military ends. There was that peacetime alliance in the offing, a cooperative reconstruction of the post-war world, at that very moment underway, with work on it to begin soon at Nuremberg. Looking down the road, Cadogan wonders later in the same diary entry regarding Katyn. How can we discuss with Russians, German war criminals, when we have condoned this? The answer would lie in more lies, for, as these novices told themselves, if they were as sensitive as O'Malley, as knowing as Cadogan, some greater good. By the end of his Katyn report, O'Malley makes the extent of this sunken state appallingly clear, even as he still has the ability to perceive it fully. We ought, maybe, to ask ourselves how, consistently with the necessities of our relations with the Soviet government, the voice of our conscience is to be kept at concert pitch. A good question with a bad answer. Our relations with the Soviet government could not under any circumstances be consistent with conscience at concert pitch. Our relations required muffling, the piano pedal, the snuffing out of morality itself. O'Malley knew that. He wrote, "It may be that the answer lies, for the moment, only in something that can be done inside our own hearts and minds where we are masters. Here, at any rate, we can make a compensatory contribution, a reaffirmation of our allegiance to truth and justice and compassion." A reaffirmation of truth and justice inside our own hearts and minds, where no one could possibly hear it. A mute pledge. A silent, private, and pointless protest that a subject, a slave, or a captive might seek succor in at the end of a humiliating, debilitating day of hard labor and deprivation. Indeed, O'Malley seems to echo the thoughts of the numbered Zek in a labor camp north of the Arctic Circle, not the declaration to the British Foreign Office by a diplomat appointed by the King of England, a soon-to-be-titled Harrow and Oxford-educated member of the ruling class, complete with ancestral family home. "Only inside our hearts and minds we are masters," O'Malley writes. "Outside, in the world, the implication is, we are not masters. Outside where we function, act, and strive, we are vassals, minions, tools. Whose tools? The master calling the shots. His name was Stalin, and he had long ago won the most important prize. What was it Kravchenko wrote? Stalin's grip on the American mind, I realized, was almost as firm as his grip on the Russian mind. Ditto the minds of all the Allies. To my knowledge, there exists no exploration into the psyche of moral slump on the American side. No reaction to O'Malley's report, if it even circulated at the top. We do know that Churchill sent FDR a copy on August 10, 1943. We also know he recorded no reaction. FDR never even acknowledged reading or even receiving it, nor did he return it to Churchill when asked repeatedly. The silent treatment was the classic mode of Roosevelt rejection. The man didn't say no, he just didn't say. Or did he never receive it? Did Hopkins intercept it? We don't know. Maybe FDR was just too busy reading another document dated August 10, 1943, likely handed to him by good old Harry. With the 1970 publication of the 1943 Quebec Conference Papers, we learned this secret memorandum was authored by General James Russian Interests Come First, Last, and Always Burns, a mainstay of Soviet Lend-Lease and the Hopkins Shop, whom we see serving as Hopkins' flunky when Admiral Standley asked Hopkins to approve a presidential order in Chapter 6. Who knows? Maybe Hopkins wrote it himself. Russia, the memo says, must be given every assistance and every effort must be made to gain her friendship. Likewise, since without question she will dominate Europe on the defeat of the Axis, it is even more essential to develop and maintain the most friendly relations with Russia. Without question? The fix was in again. Once again, it didn't have to be this way. On August 11, 1943, John C. Wiley, a Soviet expert in the OSS, wrote a lengthy letter to FDR, a bullet-like blast, warning the president of Soviet designs on Eastern and Central Europe and explaining how not to be maneuvered into aiding and abetting the rape of a large part of Europe. Wiley recommended the expeditious setup of a second front, but in the Balkans, where it could best influence the course of the war, diplomatic relations with the Kremlin, and the peace to come. True, a Balkan front is difficult, but if it is merely difficult and not impossible, we must, by all means, set up the Balkan front. An invasion of France and the lowlands would give us no political authority in Central and Eastern Europe. Only a successful Anglo-American invasion of Southeastern Europe can give us a real voice in the eventual peace settlement. It was a busy mailbag that August. A few days before Wiley wrote his letter to the president, on August 7, 1943, the director of the FBI received an anonymous letter written in Russian that identified leading KGB officers operating under diplomatic cover from Canada and the United States to Mexico. The identifications all proved to be accurate. The letter also correctly ID'd Zubilin/Zarubin as the chief KGB officer in the United States, just as it also correctly claimed he had participated in the Katyn Forest massacre, at the time, of course, officially attributed to Germany. We already know without doubt that co-president Hopkins knew Zubilin/Zarubin was a Soviet intelligence officer seeking U.S. military secrets. Did he also know he was a mass murderer? I keep looking through Robert Sherwood's authoritative two volumes about Hopkins, circa 1939 to 1945, but I can't find anything written about the Katyn Forest massacre or the ensuing diplomatic blow-up and fire-snuffing among the Allies. As for the 1987 McGimsey biography, completed with access to additional papers held by Hopkins' children and from elsewhere, Katine gets one crummy paragraph. Hopkins' reaction, meanwhile, gets one sentence, as distilled from a Joseph Davies diary entry. Angered by this complication, Hopkins dismissed the Poles as troublemakers, influenced by large Polish landlords who wanted to make sure their estates were not lost to the Russians. Via Venona, we learn that Zerubin/Zubilin warned, thanks to Hopkins' passing FBI intelligence to the Soviet embassy in May 1943, was also a key operative in the mass murder of the Poles at Katyn, a chilling revelation that brings not just the proverbial elephant, but the real-life evil empire into the room. Thankfully, we do have at least one American's very different response to the same appalling Katyn situation, that of George H. Earle. Earle, American blue blood, Harvard dropout, lawyer, sugar magnate, diplomat, polo player, dog breeder, was what is known in swashbuckling terms as a man of action. He fought Pancho Villa with Pershing, enlisted in World War I, winning the Navy Cross commanding a submarine chaser, which was his own private yacht, and served as a New Deal governor of Pennsylvania. He also insulted Hitler to his face. "I have nothing against the Germans, I just don't like you." He beamed a Nazi officer in a Bulgarian cafe with a champagne bottle when said Nazi objected too vociferously to Earl's song request of Tipperary. Even George H. Earle was unable to break the Katyn moral paralysis, but he tried. Earle became a special representative of FDR's abroad, returning to Washington in May 1944. He brought with him a dossier of photos and affidavits he had gathered in Europe that implicated the Soviets in the Katyn atrocity. Testifying in 1952 before a select congressional committee called to investigate Katyn and its cover-up, Earle described arriving with his Katyn dossier at Union Station, where he was met by an old friend, Joe Levy of the New York Times. Levy, Earle testified, told Earle that bringing an anti-Soviet report on Katyn to FDR would be a career ender. As Earle told Congress, Levy said, "George, you don't know what you're going to over there. Harry Hopkins has complete domination over the president, and the whole atmosphere over there is pink." Pink, by the way, was cute speak for pro-communist and pro-Soviet, but a pink atmosphere was toxic to truth-tellers, particularly to their careers. Earle didn't care. Like Whittaker Chambers bearing witness for the first time in September 1939, like Solzhenitsyn still fighting his way toward the American line on the Eastern Front, like Major Jordan knocking on doors in January of that same year to alert the authorities to his lend-lease suspicions, like Kravchenko, who had just defected in April and was now in hiding, Earle just wanted to get his evidence before the president. When he did, he went over the photos with Roosevelt with a magnifying glass. He took him through the affidavits he had from Bulgarian Red Cross and White Russian sources. Roosevelt wasn't buying. FDR waved off every piece of evidence. As Earle later told Congress, he said, "George, this is entirely German propaganda and a German plot. I am absolutely convinced the Russians did not do this." Earle replied by telling the president he completely disagreed. "Mr. President, I think this evidence overwhelming." Earle, like Bullitt and Wiley before him, went on to offer FDR an appraisal of Soviet intentions to seize swaths of Europe. As Earle testified, he told the president that the Russian menace was actually greater than the German menace. "I said, Mr. President, I am very much worried about this Russian situation. I feel that they are a great menace, and I feel that they have done their best to deceive the American people about this Katyn massacre, and also, primarily and most important of all, by this dreadful book of Joe Davies' Mission to Moscow, which made Stalin out as a benign Santa Claus. We never recovered from that. It made such an impression on the American people. Earl probably didn't realize the extent to which both versions of Mission to Moscow, the 1941 book and the 1943 Warner Brothers movie, were, in a very real sense, White House creations, as described earlier. "This will last," FDR had written in his own copy. So it did, at least in the Roosevelt White House. Earl's audience with FDR came to an end. "I felt pretty hopeless after that," Earl said. "In the anteroom, there I met Secretary James Forrestal of the Navy and talked to him about it, and he said, 'My God, I think this is dreadful. We were all alone over here. Russia can do no wrong. It is perfectly dreadful.' He said, 'They just simply are blind to the whole situation.'" Forrestal asked Earl to come over and talk some more about this dire situation at the White House, but Earl never did, much as he told Congress to his later regret. Forrestal committed suicide in 1949. What was it Earl's pal said about the White House atmosphere being pink? Airless, too. Its doors hermetically sealed against facts. Its shades down to block evidence that might undermine an ideologically correct state of being. Earl never did manage to bust through. Finally, almost a year later, he had had it. With major operations over and the war wrapping up, Earl would try to see FDR one more time, be rebuffed by an aide at the White House door, and later send a message to FDR. He sent it in a letter to FDR's daughter, Anna Bettinger, not to FDR directly, because, as he told Congress, he was afraid, with Roosevelt Secretary Steve Early away, it might not get to Roosevelt otherwise. No one questioned Earl on what he meant by that, but I note that elsewhere in Earl's evidence, he specifically stated that all of his dispatches went to Roosevelt directly or through Harry Hopkins. We already know that Hopkins openly discussed withholding from FDR cablegrams, even from Winston Churchill, if they crossed his policy recommendations. Was interference from Hopkins, then at the Mayo Clinic, or others, something Earl was aware or suspicious of? In his letter of March 21st, 1945, Earl told Anna he'd been brushed off by the White House due to his anti-Russian views, which constituted, as he put it, telling your father the truth about conditions in Russia and in countries occupied by Russia. Earl went on to make a proposition. "Unless the president objects," he wrote, "I want to present the following to the members of Congress and to the American people. I shall point out why Russia today is a far greater menace than Germany ever was, because of its manpower, natural resources, prospect of Bolshevizing Europe, including Germany, and because of its millions of fifth columnists. I shall show how Russia, 25 years after its revolution, is exactly the same Red Terror it was then, of its 15 million people in concentration camps, of its treatment of the Jews and of labor. I shall prove how Stalin deliberately started this war with his pact of friendship with Hitler, so that the capitalistic nations would destroy each other." By this time, as Earl later pointed out to Congress, the major fighting in Europe was over. The expediencies of military alliance no longer existed. On the other hand, the political fight FDR, or conceivably his advisors, waged on behalf of the USSR had actually intensified. In a letter dated March 24th, 1945, FDR wrote, "Dear George, I have read your letter of March 21st to my daughter Anna, and I have noted with concern your plan to publicize your unfavorable opinion of one of our allies at the very time when such a publication
from a former emissary of mine might do irreparable harm to our war effort. As you say, you have held important positions of trust under your government. To publish information obtained in those positions without proper authority would be all the greater betrayal. You say you will publish unless you are told before that I do not wish you to do so. I not only do not wish it, but I specifically forbid you to publish any information or opinion about an ally that you may have acquired while in office or in the service of the United States Navy. I am sorry that pressure of affairs prevented me from seeing you on Monday. I value our old association, and I hope that time and circumstance may someday permit a renewal of our good understanding.
So ordered, Earl asked to be released from active service. He got his answer a few days later, as Lawrence Reese reports, while sitting in a boat, fishing in a remote Maryland lake. Suddenly, he looked up and saw another boat coming toward him. On board were two FBI agents. They came alongside and said, "Mr. Earl, we have a letter for you." It contained the news that, with immediate effect, Earl had been appointed head of the Samoan Defense Group. Samoa is a whole lot better than Siberia, but the effect, silencing political opposition, was similar. I know I promised a simple chronology, but it turns out there is nothing simple about these tangled timelines. Almost no sooner had Earl been dispatched to the South Pacific than another Katyn report, like a corpse washing up on the tide, arrived in Washington. It was shortly after VE Day, May 8, 1945. This one came in the person of Lieutenant Colonel John Van Vliet, a fourth-generation West Pointer who had been captured by German forces while fighting in North Africa. Van Vliet was among a group of several American and British officers the Germans had taken to witness the exhumation of the mass graves at Katyn, to examine the evidence therein that proved that the atrocity was Soviet, not Nazi. Upon liberation from a POW camp south of Berlin, ironically by the Red Army, Van Vliet made his way to American lines and home to the States as quickly as possible so he could report on what he had seen. As Van Vliet would tell Congress in 1952, he arrived at Katyn in April 1943, predisposed to disbelieve any German version of events. Evidence of Soviet guilt, however, was overwhelming. For example, the dead reserve officers were wearing heavy winter clothes, while the Soviets claimed a German slaughter had taken place in August, which looked new, as did their leather boots. To Van Vliet, dressed in his own shabby uniform, this seemed to contradict the claim that the Poles had been prisoners for 3 years when, according to the Soviet version of events, they were supposedly killed. The newspapers, notebooks, and diaries that came out of the graves, too, were compelling circumstantial evidence. None was dated past the spring of 1940. What Van Vliet wanted to bring home ASAP were the facts on the ground, the indicators of Soviet perfidy, the solid foundation of understanding on which to base our judgments and future course of action, a place from which to see reality itself. Of course, Katyn was just another installment in the horrific Soviet story of blood, deception, and conquest. The circumstances and details were different, but it was the same story Bullitt told FDR in January 1943, the same story George Racy Jordan tried to tell in January 1944, the same story Kravchenko alerted the American public to on defecting in March 1944. It was what Solzhenitsyn, as a Red Army captain, wanted to warn U.S. troops about in 1945, What made Whittaker Chambers offer government officials secrets about the Soviet conspiracy back in September 1939? What Eugene Lyons came clean about in the late 1930s? What Martin Dies did so much heroic work to uncover piece by piece on establishing the House Committee on Un-American Activities in 1938? What young Gareth Jones told the world about in 1933, only to be tackled by the Emperor's courtiers? Like his predecessors, Van Vliet probably believed it was simply the facts that were missing, that when he corrected the figuring, the whole equation would suddenly come right. What none of these men understood, at least at first, was that the facts, their implications, the truth, and reality itself were all anathema in Uncle Sam's communist-influenced, communist-occupied corridors of power. Imagine the haste with which Lieutenant Colonel John Van Vliet strode those same corridors in the spanking new Pentagon to get to the office of Army Intelligence G2 Chief General Clayton Bissell on Tuesday, May 22, 1945. "Looking thin, tense, and tired," Bissell's words, Van Vliet proceeded to dictate his vivid recollections in what became known as the Van Vliet Report on Katyn. It made a cogent, convincing case for Soviet guilt. Van Vliet initialed it. Bissell read it, tagged it top secret. As Van Vliet would write in 1950, "The general then dictated the letter directing me to silence and had me sign a copy of it in his presence. He explained to me the importance of my remaining silent, gave me my copy of the letter, and thanked me." The importance of remaining silent. Why? That's what Congress wanted to know starting in late 1949, when its investigation into the cover-up of the Katyn massacre began, after the appearances earlier that year of two compelling articles in the New York Herald Tribune by the tenacious journalist and historian Julius Epstein. Epstein's research debunked the US-USSR story that the Katyn massacre was a Nazi atrocity, the version of events still disseminated by the US government, until 1950, when, inspired by Epstein's research, Congress, specifically Representative George A. Dundero of Michigan, began demanding a reckoning. Congress also wanted to know what in tarnation had become of the Van Vliet Report, the key eyewitness account in Katyn history, whose existence Epstein had learned about. The Army and the State Department couldn't find it anywhere. In fact, the Van Vliet Report, get ready for this, had vanished from government archives. It seems that Owen O'Malley's darkened vision of cover-up in the picturesque form of little conifers had lived on even after the overriding rationale, winning the war against Nazi Germany at all costs, even an alliance with the devil, was no more. When Van Vliet made his report, Nazi Germany was no more, but we were still kicking dirt over evidence of Soviet murder. Why? This time, it was for the sake of the peace. The report of the Select Committee to Investigate Katyn elaborated on this mindset. General Bissell himself admitted to the Madding Committee that had the Van Vliet report been publicized in 1945, when agreements for creating a United Nations organization reached at Yalta were being carried out in San Francisco, Soviet Russia might never have taken a seat in this international organization. The timelines overlap. A couple of days before newly liberated Van Vliet told his story to Army Intelligence, the New York Times reported, "New security charter seems to be assured." The day before Van Vliet showed up in General Bissell's office, the UN story of the day was, "San Francisco Outlook, hope of banning war, stirs world despite history's somber teaching." It was as if General Bissell believed He was saving the world by creating an alternate universe. Deep-sixing the Van Vliet report with a top-secret stamp to keep reality at bay. This rationale we now know as politicizing the intelligence. It means editing the facts, omitting the facts, to fit an ideology, the belief, the dream, the hallucination, that damn existing view of the world. This all very much dismayed the Madden Committee, which chastised Bissell for considering political significance of the Van Vliet document, which should have been treated objectively from a strictly military intelligence standpoint. Treated objectively? An indictment of the Soviet Union? Communism? By Uncle Joe's vassals? As Bissell's explanation demonstrates, the interests of the Soviet enterprise dominated the thinking of the United States establishment, even the Chief of Army Intelligence. Bissell stated, "I saw in it," Van Vliet's report, "great possibilities of embarrassment, so I classified it the way I have told you. And I think I had no alternative." Sure, General, far better for the national soul, for the well-being of this nation and others, for the peace, for the future, for the sacrifice of the dead, to suppress the facts of Katyn, to save the Soviet Union from embarrassment. The Katyn cover-up was another stake through the body of moral teachings once upheld in the Judeo-Christian world as guiding principles. It was a foundation of the laughably named United Nations, formed from the fractured basis of destabilizing falsehood and moral compromise. 40 years later, Jean J. Kirkpatrick would make a similar point when she offered an overview of American post-war foreign policy in a 1985 Commentary magazine symposium. The entire concept of the UN, she wrote, was based from the outset on falsification. This began, she continued, with the basic fact that the USSR was not, as the UN Charter assumed of all members, a democracy with democratic values. Founding the UN required denying and falsifying the nature of the Soviet Union, she wrote. Optimism about the new era of peace and the United Nations was maintained only by denial, and it was falsehood-based denial and fantasy, Kirkpatrick observed, that became permanent features of the post-war world. Yes, but denial and fantasy were already permanent features of the world before the war. In fact, it's difficult to imagine circumstances under which the UN could have or would have been founded if such denial and fantasy were not already regnant. America's official and trumpeted acquiescence to the UN principles of world government then came at the end of a long moral slump that began with Soviet recognition in 1933, that continued with wartime alliance in 1941, that accelerated with the cover-up of Katyn in 1943 and beyond. We had long fallen in behind the evil emperor, surrendering a strategic swath of moral sovereignty that would never be reclaimed so long as we clung to the edges of his bloody train. We may chide the Soviets for repressing the truth about Katyn until 1989, but for an unbelievable 8 crucial years, U.S. government organs, Office of War Information, Voice of America, etc., parroted this same Soviet disinformation. Even as late as 1978, an anniversary report on Katyn from Voice of America's correspondent in Poland was edited in Washington to remove mention of Soviet guilt. Such patterns of censorship and, worse, self-censorship do things to people, do things to our vision and grasp of the truth, our respect for facts, our reliance on judgment. The less respect we accord facts, the less secure we can be in our judgment, and the more that mystery holes filled with lies begin to pock the record. So full of holes is our record that trying to find a way back to the facts as scrambled by con artists and partly reassembled by patient scholars is like traveling blind with a half-torn map across a land of booby traps, a hostile terrain where landmarks, the most crucial official documents, have been ransacked or destroyed altogether. Where do we find our bearings after learning that Army intelligence during this period functioned as an adjunct of the NKVD in disposing of the Van Vliet report? After learning, as Congress reported, that there was a pool of pro-Soviet civilian employees and some military in Army intelligence who apologized for almost everything that the Soviet Union did, that this same pool exerted tremendous efforts to suppress anti-Soviet reports, that it ensured that officers too critical of the Soviets were bypassed for promotion. So testified three high-ranking Army intelligence officers whom the committee investigating Katyn heard in executive session. Their full testimony should be part of the open record now. However, as M. Stanton Evans reports, Unfortunately for the historical record, the transcript of the executive hearing itself has vanished from the National Archives. Vanished. What more could the NKVD have done to subvert and twist our record, except for maybe killing Van Vliet himself? That didn't happen, of course. Although maybe the "of course" is a bit smug. Maybe Van Vliet was lucky. Or maybe an American uniform provided sufficient protection. Not so lucky was Ivan Krivosertsov, a Russian peasant who spent his boyhood near the woods at Katyn, who knew of a time when it was a place to gather firewood, mushrooms, and berries. Then came the Russian Revolution, and then came the secret police. First the Cheka, then the OGPU, then the NKVD, then the NKGB seized the secluded area, perfect for summary executions. Never were there so many executions as there were in that spring of 1940. Krivosertsov knew that too. Krivosertsov saw the prison trains arriving, the Polish officers inside arriving, then departing in Black Ravens, prison cars, with NKVD escorts. He heard the talk of the Black Raven driver, a lorry driver, a relative. The NKVD were shooting the Polish officers in the woods. Later, he saw the graves himself and a small wooden cross. In the spring of 1943, Krivosertsov was the person who first showed these mass graves to incoming German troops, after which he worked for 3 months digging them up. Later in the war, when the Germans retreated, the peasant retreated with them. He worked in a railway yard in Berlin after that, at least until the Red Army arrived. Krivosertsov watched, furtively, as American and British troops fraternized with the Red Army. This perturbed him. Like the brilliant Solzhenitsyn, the uneducated peasant thought the Americans and British should learn the true nature of their Soviet ally. He made it his business to try to tell them what he knew of the horrific slaughter in the woods at Katyn. He had a terrible time making himself understood. An American military policeman almost did the peasant the favor of returning him to Soviet custody. Finally, Krivosertsov made his way to a Polish displaced persons camp in western Germany. So it was that on May 31, 1945, 9 days after Van Vliet made his top-secret statement in Washington, D.C., and was ordered into silence, Krivosertsov made his statement about Katyn to a Polish chaplain. That statement would be entered into the 1952 congressional records of the Katyn cover-up investigation. Ivan would make it to England, where he lived and worked quietly under a new name. Kept to himself mainly, although he made a new Russian friend, or so the story goes. One day in 1947, Ivan didn't show up for work. No one knew where he was until he was finally found outside London, far from his place of work, in an empty shed near an abandoned orchard, hanged. The authorities said it was suicide, but they said very little. It was second nature by then.